face. His uniform seemed to be a sufficient guarantee of gallery privileges, but he kept the parchment clutched visibly in both hands as an added assurance. He scanned the first-floor galleries, found no sign of his quarry, and continued upward. He found Giancana Maraggio on the third floor, just as the guard had indicated. Maraggio stood staring out at the public gallery, abstractedly, as he listened to a pair of finickers behind him read from wax tablets figures that meant very little to Locke. Maraggio didn't seem to keep a bodyguard near his person. Apparently he felt safe enough within the bounds of his commercial kingdom. So much the better. Locke stepped right up beside him, relishing the arrogance of the gesture, and stood waiting to be noticed. The finickers and several nearby gallery members started muttering to themselves. After a few seconds, Maraggio turned and let the full power of his storm lantern glare rest on Locke. It took only a moment for that glare to shift from irritation to suspicion. "You," said Maraggio, "do not work for me." "I bring greetings from Caparaza of Camor," said Locke, in a quiet and respectful voice. "I have a very serious matter to bring to your attention, Master Maraggio." The master of the counting house stared at him, then removed his optics and tucked them in a coat pocket. "So it's true, then. I'd heard Barsavi had gone the way of all flesh, and now your master sends a lackey. How kind of him. What's his business?" "His business is rather congruent with yours, Master Maraggio. I'm here to save your life." Maraggio snorted. "My life is hardly in danger, my improperly dressed friend. This is my house, and any guard here would cut your balls off with two words from me. If I were you, I'd start explaining where you got that uniform." "I purchased it," said Locke, "from one of your waiters, a man by the name of Benjavir. I knew he was tractable because he's already in on the plot against your life."
"Ben? God's damn it! What proof have you?"
"I have several of your guards holding him down by your service entrance, rather half-dressed."
"What do you mean, you have several of my guards holding him? Who the hell do you think you are?"
"Caparaza has given me the job of saving your life, Master Maraggio. I mean exactly what I said. And as for who I am, I happen to be your savior."
"My guards and my waiters are not reliable," hissed Locke. "Are you blind? I didn't purchase this at a second-hand clothier. I walked right in through your service entrance, offered a few crowns, and your man Benjavir was out of his uniform like that." Locke snapped his fingers. "Your guard at the service door slipped me in for much less, just a solon. Your men are not made of stone, Master Maraggio. You presume much concerning their fidelity." Maraggio stared at him, colour rising in his cheeks. He looked as though he was about to strike Locke. Instead, he coughed and held out his hands, palms up.
"Tell me what you came to tell me," said Maraggio. "I'll take my own counsel from there."
"Your finickers are crowding me. Dismiss them and give us a bit of privacy."
"Don't tell me what to do in my own—"
"I will tell you what to do, goddammit," Locke spat. "I am your fucking bodyguard, Master Maraggio. You are in deadly danger. Minutes count. You already know of at least one compromised waiter and one lax guard. How much longer are you going to prevent me from keeping you alive?"
"Why is Caparaza so concerned for my safety?"
"Your personal comfort likely means nothing to him," said Locke. "The safety of the Maraggio, however, is of paramount importance. An assassination contract has been taken out against you by Ferrari commercial interests who wish to see Camor's fortunes diminished. Raza has been in power for 4 days. Your assassination would shake the city to its foundations. The Spider and the City Watch would tear Raza's people apart looking for answers. He simply cannot allow harm to come to you. He must keep this city stable, as surely as the Duke must."
"And how does your master know all of this?"
"A gift from the gods," said Locke. "Letters were intercepted while my master's agents were pursuing an unrelated matter. Please dismiss your finickers." Maraggio pondered for a few seconds, then grunted and waved his attendants away with an irritated wrist flick. They backed off, wide-eyed.
"Someone very nasty is after you," said Locke. "It's a crossbow job. The assassin is Lashani. Supposedly his weapons have been altered by a Kathani bondsmage. He's slippery as all hell, and he almost always hits the mark. Be flattered. We believe his fee is 10,000 crowns.
"This is a great deal to swallow, master."
"My name isn't important," said Locke. "Come with me, down to the receiving room behind the kitchens. You can talk to Benjavir yourself."
"The receiving room behind the kitchens?"
Maraggio frowned deeply.
"As yet I have no reason to believe that you yourself might not be trying to lure me there for mischief."
"Master Maraggio," said Locke, "you are wearing silk and cotton, not chain mail. I have had you at dagger reach for several minutes now. If my master wished you dead, your entrails would be staining the carpet. You don't have to thank me, you don't even have to like me, but for the love of the gods, please accept that I have been ordered to guard you, and one does not refuse the orders of the Cupper of Camor."
The point. Is he as formidable a man as Barsavi was, this Caparaza?
Barsavi died weeping at his feet, said Locke. Barsavi and all of his children. Draw your own conclusions.
Maraggio slipped his optics back onto his nose, adjusted his orchid, and put his hands behind his back.
"We shall go to the receiving room," he said. "You lead the way."
5. Benjavir and the guards alike looked terrified when Maraggio stormed into the receiving room behind Locke. Locke guessed they were more attuned to the man's moods than he was, and what they saw on his face must have been something truly unpleasant.
"Benjavir," said Maraggio, "Benjavir, I simply cannot believe it. After all I did for you, after I took you in and cleared up that mess with your old ship's captain, I haven't the words."
"I'm sorry, Master Maraggio,"
said the waiter, whose cheeks were wetter than the sloped roof of a house in a storm.
"I'm so sorry. I didn't mean anything by it."
"Didn't mean anything by it? Is it true, what this man has been telling me?"
"Oh, yes. Gods forgive me, Master Maraggio. It's true. It's all true. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Please believe me."
"Be silent, gods damn your eyes!"
Maraggio stood, jaw agape, like a man who'd just been slapped. He looked around him as though seeing the receiving room for the first time, as though the liveried guards were alien beings. He seemed ready to stagger and fall backward. Instead, he whirled on Locke with his fists clenched.
"Tell me everything you know," he growled. "By the gods, everyone involved in this affair is going to learn the length of my reach. I swear it."
"First things first, you must live out the afternoon. You have private apartments above the 4th floor gallery, right?"
"Of course."
"Let us go there immediately," said Locke. "Have this poor bastard thrown into a storeroom. Surely you have one that would suffice. You can deal with him when this affair is over. For the now, time is not our friend."
Benjavir burst into loud sobs once again, and Maraggio nodded, looking disgusted.
"Put Benjavir in dry storage and bolt the door. You too stand watch. And you..."
The service door guard had been peeking his head around the corner again. He flushed red.
"Let another unauthorized person, so much as a small child, in through that door this afternoon, and I'll have your balls cut out and hot coals put in their places. Is that clear?"
Perfectly clear, Master Maraggio, sir."
Maraggio turned and swept out of the room, and this time it was Locke at his heels, hurrying to keep up. 6. Giancana Maraggio's fortified private apartments were of a kind with the man's clothing, richly furnished in the most subtle fashion. The man clearly preferred to let materials and craftsmanship serve as his primary ornaments. The steel-reinforced door clicked shut behind them, and the Ferrari lockbox rattled as its teeth slid home within the wood. Moraggio and Locke were alone. The elegant miniature water clock on Moraggio's lacquered desk was just filling the bowl that marked the first hour of the afternoon.
"Now," said Locke, "Master Moraggio, you cannot be out on the floor again until our assassin is sewn up. It is not safe. We expected the attack to come between the first and fourth hour of the afternoon."
"That will cause problems," said Moraggio. "I have business to look after. My absence on the floor will be noticed."
"Not necessarily," said Locke. "Has it not occurred to you that we are of a very similar build, and that one man, in the shadows of one of the upper-level galleries, might look very much like another?"
You propose to masquerade as me?"
"In the letters we intercepted," said Locke, "we received one piece of information that is very much to our advantage. The assassin did not receive a detailed description of your appearance. Rather, he was instructed to put his bolt into the only man in the counting-house wearing a rather large orchid at the breast of his coat. If I were to be dressed as you, in your customary place in the gallery, with an orchid pinned to my coat, well, that bolt would be coming at me rather than you."
"I find it hard to believe that you're saintly enough to be willing to put yourself in my place, if this assassin is as deadly as you say."
"Master Moraggio," said Locke, "begging your pardon, but I plainly haven't made myself clear. If I don't do this on your behalf, my master will kill me anyway. Furthermore, I am perhaps more adept at ducking the embrace of the Lady of the Long Silence than you might imagine. Lastly, the reward I have been promised for bringing this affair to a satisfactory close, well, if you were in my shoes, you'd be willing to face a bolt as well."
"What would you have me do in the meantime?"
"Take your ease in these apartments," said Locke. "Keep the doors tightly shut. Amuse yourself for a few hours. I suspect we won't have long to wait."
"And what happens when the assassin lets fly his bolt?"
"I am ashamed to have to admit," said Locke, "that my master has at least a half-dozen other men out on the floor of your counting-house today. Please don't be upset. Some of your clients are not clients. They are the sharpest, roughest lads Capa Raza has, old hands at fast, quiet work. When our assassin takes his shot, they'll move on him. Between them and your own guards, he'll never know what hit him."
"And if you aren't as fast as you think you are, and that bolt hits home?"
"Then I'll be dead, and you'll still be alive, and my master will be satisfied," said Locke. "We swear oaths in my line of work as well, Master Moraggio. I serve Raza even unto death. So what's it going to be?"
7. Locke Lamora stepped out of Moraggio's apartments at 1:30, dressed in the most excellent coat, vest, and breeches he had ever worn. They were the dark blue of the sky just before false light, and he thought the colour suited him remarkably well. The white silk tunic was as cool as autumn river water against his skin. It was fresh from Moraggio's closet, as were the hose, shoes, cravats, and gloves. His hair was slicked back with rose oil. A little bottle of the stuff rested in his pocket, along with a purse of gold tyrins he'd lifted from Moraggio's wardrobe drawers. Moraggio's orchid was pinned at his right breast, still crisply fragrant. It smelled pleasantly like raspberries. Moraggio's finickers had been appraised of the masquerade, along with a select few of his guards. They nodded at Locke as he strolled out into the fourth-floor members' gallery, sliding Moraggio's optics over his eyes. That was a mistake. The world went blurry. Locke cursed his own absent-mindedness as he slipped them back into his coat. His old fair-white optics had been clear fakes, but of course Moraggio's actually functioned for Moraggio's eyes. A point to remember. Casually, as though it were all part of his plan, Locke stepped onto the black iron stairs and headed downward. From a distance, he certainly resembled Moraggio well enough to cause no comment. When he reached the floor of the public gallery, he strolled through rapidly enough to gather only a few odd looks in his wake. He plucked the orchid from his breast and shoved it into a pocket as he entered the kitchen. At the entrance to the dry storage room, he waved to the two guards and jerked a thumb over his shoulder. "Master Maraggio wants you two watching the back door. Give Laval a hand. Nobody comes in, just as he said, on pain of, hot coals. You heard the old man. I need a word with Benjavir." The guards looked at one another and nodded. Locke's presumed authority over them now seemed to be so cemented that he supposed he could have strolled back here in ladies' small clothes and gotten the same response. Maraggio had probably used a few special agents in the past to whip his operations into shape. No doubt Locke was now riding on the coattails of their reputations. Benjavir looked up as Locke entered the storage room and slid the door shut behind him. Sheer bewilderment registered on his face. He was so surprised when Locke threw a coin purse at him that the little leather bag struck him in the eye. Benjavir cried out and fell back against the wall, both hands over his face. "Shit!" said Locke. "Beg pardon, you were meant to catch that." "What do you want now?" "I came to apologize. I don't have time to explain. I'm sorry I dragged you into this, but I have my reasons, and I have needs that must be met."
"Sorry you dragged me into this?"
Benjavir's voice broke. He sniffed once and spat at Locke.
"What the fuck are you talking about? What's going on? What does Master Maraggio think I did?"
"I don't have time to sing you a tale. I put 6 crowns in that bag. Some of it's in Tyrins, so you can break it down easier. Your life won't be worth shit if you stay in Camor. Get out through the landward gates. Get my old clothes from the welcoming shade. Here's the key." This time Benjavir caught what was thrown at him. "Now," said Locke, "no more goddamned questions. I'm going to grab you by the ear and haul you out into the alley. You make like you're scared shitless. When we're around the corner and out of sight, I'm going to let you go. If you have any love for life, you fucking run to the welcoming shade, get dressed, and get the hell out of the city. Make for Talisham or Ashmir. You've got more than a year's pay there in that purse. You should be able to do something with it."
"I don't..."
"We go now," said Locke, "or I leave you here to die. Understanding is a luxury. You don't get to have it. Sorry." A moment later, Locke was hauling the waiter into the receiving room by the earlobe. This particular come-along was a painful hold well known to any guard or watchman in the city. Benjavir did a very acceptable job of wailing and sobbing and pleading for his life. The 3 guards at the service door looked on without sympathy as Locke hauled the waiter past them.
"Back in a few minutes," said Locke. "Master Maraggio wants me to have a few more words with this poor bastard in private." "Oh, gods!" cried Benjavir. "Don't let him take me away! He's going to hurt me! Please!"
The guards chuckled at that, although the one who'd originally taken Locke's soul on didn't seem quite as mirthful as the other two. Locke dragged Benjavir down the alley and around the corner. The moment they were cut off from the sight of the 3 guards, Locke pushed him away.
"Go," he said. "Run like hell. I give them maybe 20 minutes before they all figure out what a pack of asses they've been, and then you'll have hard men after you in squads. Go!"
Benjavir stared at him, then shook his head and stumbled off toward the welcoming shade. Locke toyed with one of the ends of his false moustaches as he watched the waiter go, and then he turned around and lost himself in the crowds. The sun was pouring down light and heat with its usual intensity, and Locke was sweating hard inside his fine new clothes, but for a few moments he let a satisfied smirk creep onto his face. He strolled north toward 2 Silver Green. There was a gentleman's trifles shop very near to the southern gate of the park, and there were other black alchemists in various districts who didn't know him by sight. A bit of adhesive dissolver to get rid of the moustache, and something to restore his hair to its natural shade. With those things in hand, he'd be Lucas Fairwhite once again, fit to visit the Salvaras and relieve them of a few thousand more crowns.
Chapter 14. 3 Invitations. 1.
"Oh, Lucas!"
Doña Sofia's smile lit up her face when she met him at the door to the Salvara manor. Yellow light spilled out past him into the night. It was just past the 11th hour of the evening. Locke had hidden himself away for most of the day following the affair at Maraggio's, and had dispatched a note by courier to let the Don and the Doña know that Fairwhite would pay them a late visit.
"It's been days. We received Grauman's note, but we were beginning to worry for our affairs. And for you, of course. Are you well?"
"My Lady Salvara, it is a pleasure to see you once again. Yes, yes, I am very well. Thank you for inquiring. I have met with some disreputable characters over the past week, but all will be for the best. One ship is secured, with cargo, and we may begin our voyage as early as next week in it. Another is very nearly in our grasp."
"Well, don't stand there like a courier on the stair. Do come in. Conte, we would have refreshment. I know, fetch out some of my oranges, the new ones. We'll be in the close chamber."
"Of course, my lady." Conte stared at Locke with narrowed eyes and a grudging half-smile. "Master Fairwhite, I do hope the knight finds you in good health." "Quite good, Conte." "How splendid. I shall return very shortly."
Almost all Camori manors had two sitting rooms near their entrance hall. One was referred to as the duty chamber, where meetings with strangers and other formal affairs would be held. It would be kept coldly, immaculately, and expensively furnished. Even the carpets would be clean enough to eat off of. The close chamber, in contrast, was for intimate and trusted acquaintances, and was traditionally furnished for sheer comfort, in a manner that reflected the personality of the lord and lady of the manor. Doña Sofia led him to the Salvara's close chamber, which held four deeply padded leather armchairs with tall backs like caricatures of thrones. Where most sitting rooms would have had little tables beside each chair, this one had four potted trees, each just slightly taller than the chair it stood beside. The trees smelled of cardamom, a scent that suffused the room. Locke looked closely at the trees. They were not saplings, as he had first thought. They were miniatures, somehow. They had leaves barely larger than his thumbnail. Their trunks were no thicker than a man's forearms, and their branches narrowed to the width of fingers. Within the twisting confines of its branches, each tree supported a small wooden shelf and a hanging alchemical lantern. Sophia tapped these to bring them to life, filling the room with amber light and green-tinted shadows. The patterns cast by the leaves onto the walls were at once fantastical and relaxing. Locke ran a finger through the soft, thin leaves of the nearest tree.
"Your handiwork is incredible, Doña Sofia," he said, "even for someone well acquainted with the work of our planting masters. We care mostly for function, for yields. You possess flair in abundance."
"Thank you, Lucas. Do be seated. Alchemically reducing the frame of larger botanicals is an old art, but one I happen to particularly enjoy as a sort of hobby. And as you can see, these are functional pieces as well. But these are hardly the greatest wonders in the room. I see you've taken up our Camori fashions."
"This? Well, one of your clothiers seemed to believe he was taking pity on me. He offered such a bargain I could not in good conscience refuse. This is by far the longest I've ever been in Camor. I decided I might as well attempt to blend in."
"How splendid!"
"Yes, it is," said Don Salvara, who strolled in fastening the buttons of his own coat cuffs. "Much better than your black Vardran prisoners' outfits. Don't get me wrong. They're quite the thing for a northern clime, but down here they look like they're trying to strangle the wearer. Now, Lucas, what's the status of all the money we've been spending?"
"One galleon is definitely ours," said Locke. "I have a crew and a suitable cargo. I'll supervise the loading myself over the next few days. It will be ready to depart next week. And I have a promising lead on a second to accompany it, ready within the same time frame."
"A promising lead," said Doña Sofia, "is not quite the same as definitely ours, unless I am very much mistaken."
"You are not, Doña Sofia."
Locke sighed and attempted to look as though he were ashamed to bring up the issue once again.
"There is some question, That is, the captain of the second vessel is being tempted by an offer to carry a special cargo to Balinel. A relatively long voyage, but for a very decent price. He has as yet to commit to my offers.
And I suppose, said Don Lorenzo, as he took a seat beside his wife, that a few thousand more crowns might need to be thrown at his feet to make him see reason?
I fear very much, my good Don Salvara, that shall be the case.
Well, we can speak of that in a moment. Here's Conte. I should quite like to show off what my lady has newly accomplished.
Conte carried 3 silver bowls on a brass platter. Each bowl held half an orange, already sliced so the segments of flesh within the fruit could be drawn out with little 2-pronged forks. Conte set a bowl, a fork, and a linen napkin down on the tree shelf to Locke's right. The Salvaras looked at him expectantly while their own orange halves were laid out. Locke worked very hard to conceal any trepidation he might have felt. He took the bowl in one hand and fished out a wedge of orange flesh with the fork. When he set it on his tongue, he was surprised at the tingling warmth that spread throughout his mouth. The fruit was saturated with something alcoholic.
"Why, it's been suffused with liquor," he said. "Something very pleasant. An orange brandy? A hint of lemon?"
"Not suffused, Lucas," said Don Lorenzo with a boyish grin that had to be quite genuine. "These oranges have been served in their natural state. Sophia's tree manufactures its own liquor and mingles it in the fruit."
"Sacred marrows," said Locke. "What an intriguing hybrid. To the best of my knowledge, it has yet to be done with citrus."
"I only arrived at the correct formulation a few months ago," said Sophia, "and some of the early growths were quite unfit for the table, but this one seems to have gone over well. Another few generations of tests, and I shall be very confident of its marketability."
"I'd like to call it the Sophia," said Don Lorenzo, "the Sophia Orange of Camor, an alchemical wonder that will make the vintners of Tal Vera cry for their mothers."
"I, for my part, should like to call it something else," said Sophia, playfully slapping her husband on his wrist.
"The planting masters," said Locke, "will find you quite as wondrous as your oranges, my lady. It is, as I said, perhaps there is more opportunity in our partnership than any of us have foreseen. The way you seem to make every green thing around you malleable, I dare say that the character of the House of Bel-Oster for the next century could be shaped more by your touch than by our old Emberlane traditions."
"You flatter me, Master Fairwhite," said the Donya, "but let us not count our ships before they're in harbour."
"Indeed," said Don Lorenzo, "and on that note I shall return us to business. Lucas, I fear I have unfortunate news for you. Unfortunate and somewhat embarrassing. I have had several setbacks in recent days. One of my upriver debtors has reneged on the large bill. Several of my other projections have proven to be overly optimistic. We are, in short, not as fluid at the moment as any of us might hope. Our ability to throw a few thousand more crowns into our mutual project is very much in doubt."
"Oh," said Locke, that is, as you say, unfortunate."
He slid another orange slice into his mouth and sucked at the sweet liquor, using it as an artificial stimulus to tilt the corners of his lips upward, quite against his natural inclination.
2. On the waterfront of the dregs, a priest of Azaguia glided from shadow to shadow, moving with a slow and patient grace that belied his size. The mist tonight was thin, the damp heat of the summer night especially oppressive. Streams of sweat ran down Jean's face behind the silver mesh of his sorrowful visage. Camori law held that the weeks before the midsummer mark and the day of changes were always the hottest of the year. Out on the water, the now familiar yellow lamps glimmered. Shouts and splashes could be heard as the men aboard the Satisfaction hauled out another boatful of charitable provisions.
Jean doubted he could learn anything more about the items going out on those boats unless he did something more obvious, like attacking one of the loading crews, and that would hardly do. So tonight he'd decided to focus his attention on a certain warehouse about a block in from the docks. The dregs weren't quite as far gone as Ashfall, but the place was well on its way. Buildings were falling down or falling sideways in every direction. The entire area seemed to be sinking down into a sort of swamp of rotted wood and fallen brick. Every year the damp ate a little more of the mortar between the district's stones, and legitimate business fled elsewhere, and more bodies turned up loosely concealed under piles of debris, or not concealed at all. While prowling in his black robes, Jean had noticed gangs of Raza's men coming and going from the warehouse for several nights in a row. The structure was abandoned, but not yet uninhabitable, as its collapsed neighbors were. Jean had observed lights burning behind its windows almost until dawn, and parties of laborers coming and going with heavy bags over their shoulders, and even a horse cart or two. But not tonight. The warehouse had previously been a hive of activity, and tonight it was dark and silent. Tonight it seemed to invite his curiosity, and while Locke was off sipping tea with the quality, Jean aimed to pry into Kappa Raza's business. There were ways to do this sort of thing, and they involved patience, vigilance, and a great deal of slow walking. He went around the warehouse block several times, avoiding all contact with anyone on the street, throwing himself into whatever deep darkness was at hand, and keeping his silver mask tucked under his arm to hide the glare. Given enough shadow, even a man Jean's size could be stealthy, and he was certainly light enough on his feet. Circling and sweeping, he established to his satisfaction that none of the roofs of nearby buildings held concealed watchers, and that there were no street eyes either. Of course, he thought to himself, as he pressed his back up against the southern wall of the warehouse, they could just be better than I am. "Azaguia, have a care," he mumbled as he edged toward one of the warehouse doors. "If you don't favor me tonight, I'll never be able to return this fine robe and mask to your servants. Just a consideration humbly submitted." There was no lock on the door. In fact, it hung slightly ajar. Jean donned his silver mask again, then slipped his hatchets into his right hand and pushed them up the sleeve of his robe. He'd want them ready for use, but not quite visible, just in case he bumped into anyone who might still be awed by his vestments. The door creaked slightly, and then he was into the warehouse, pressed up against the wall beside the door, watching and listening. The darkness was thick, crisscrossed by the overlying mesh of his mask. There was a strange smell in the air, above the expected smell of dirt and rotting wood, something like burnt metal. He held his position, motionless, straining for several long minutes to catch any sound. There was nothing but the far-off creak and sigh of ships at anchor, and the sound of the hangman's wind blowing out to sea. He reached beneath his robe with his left hand and drew out an alchemical light globe, much like the one he'd carried beneath the echo hole. He gave it a series of rapid shakes, and it flared into incandescence. By the pale white light of the globe, he saw that the warehouse was one large open space. A pile of wrecked and rotted partitions against the far wall might have been an office at one time. The floor was hard-packed dirt, and here and there in corners or against walls were piles of debris, some under tarps. Jean carefully adjusted the position of the globe, keeping it pressed close against his body so that it threw out light only in a forward arc. That would help to keep his activity unseen. He didn't intend to spend more than a few minutes poking around in this place. As he slowly paced toward the northern end of the warehouse, he became aware of another unusual odor, one that raised his hackles. Something had been dumped in this place and left to rot. Meat, perhaps, but the odor was sickly sweet. Jean was afraid he knew what it was even before he found the bodies. There were four of them, thrown under a heavy tarp in the northeastern corner of the building, three men and one woman. They were fairly muscular, dressed in undertunics and breeches, with heavy boots and leather gloves. This puzzled Jean until he peered at their arms and saw their tattoos.
It was traditional in Camor for journeyman artists to mark their hands or arms with some symbol of their trade. Breathing through his mouth to avoid the stench, Jean shifted the bodies around until he could be sure of those symbols. Someone had murdered a pair of glass wrights and a pair of goldsmiths. Three of the corpses had obvious stab wounds, and the fourth, the woman, she had a pair of raised purple welts on one cheek of her waxy, bloodless face. Jean sighed and let the tarp settle back down on top of the bodies. As he did, his eye caught the glimmer of reflected light from the floor. He knelt down and picked up a speck of glass, a sort of flattened drop. It looked as though it had hit the ground in a molten state and cooled there. A brief flick of the light globe showed him dozens of these little glass specks in the dirt around the tarp.
"Asaguia," Jean whispered. "I stole these robes, but don't hold it against these people. If I'm the only death prayer they get, please judge them lightly, for the sorrow of their passing and the indignity of their resting place. Crooked Warden, if you could back that up somehow, I'd greatly appreciate it."
There was a creak as the doors on the northern wall of the building were pushed open. Jean started to leap backward, but thought better of it. His light was no doubt already seen, and it would be best to play the dignified priest of Azaguia. His hatchets remained up his right sleeve. The last people he expected to walk through the north door of the warehouse were the Barangias sisters. Sherin and Raiza wore oil cloaks, but the hoods were thrown back and their shark's teeth bangles gleamed by the light of Jean's globe. Each of the sisters held a light globe as well. They shook them, and a powerful red glare rose up within the warehouse, as though each woman were cupping fire in the palms of her hands.
"Inquisitive priest," said one of the sisters, "a good evening to you." "Not the sort of place," said the other, "where your order usually prowls without invitation."
"My order is concerned with death in every form and in every place."
Jean gestured toward the tarp with his light globe.
"There has been a foul act committed here. I was saying a death prayer, which is what every soul is due before it passes into the long silence."
"Oh, a foul act. Shall we leave him to his business, Sherin?"
"No," said Raiza, "for his business has been curiously concerned with ours these past few nights, hasn't it?"
"You're right, sister. Once or twice a prowling, that we might excuse, but this priest has been persistent."
"Unusually persistent."
The Barangias sisters were coming toward him, slowly, smiling like cats advancing on a crippled mouse.
"On our docks, and now in our warehouse."
"Do you dare suggest," said Jean, his heart racing, "that you intend to interfere with an envoy of the Lady of the Long Silence, of Azaguia, the goddess of death herself?"
"Interfering's what we do professionally, I'm afraid," said the sister on his right. "We left the place open just in case you might want to stick your head in.
Hoped you wouldn't be able to resist.
And we know a thing or two about the Lady Most Kind ourselves, although our service to her is a bit more direct than yours."
With that, red light gleamed on naked steel. Each sister had drawn out a curved, arm-length blade, thieves' teeth, just as Maranzala had shown him so many years earlier. The Barangias twins continued their steady approach.
"Well," said Jean, "if we're already past the pleasantries, ladies, allow me to quit this masquerade."
Jean tossed his light globe on the ground, reached up, pulled back his black hood, and slipped off his mask.
"Tannen!" said the sister on his right. "Well, holy shit! So you didn't go out through the Viscount's gate after all?"
The Barangias sisters halted, staring at him. Then they began circling to his left, moving in graceful unison, giving themselves more space to take action.
"You have some cheek," said the other, "impersonating a priest of Azaguia."
"Beg pardon? You were going to kill a priest of Azaguia."
Yes, well, you seem to have saved us from that particular blasphemy, haven't you? This is convenient, said the other sister. I never dreamed it'd be this easy.
Oh, whatever it is, said Jean, I guarantee it won't be easy.
Did you like our work in your little glass cellar? The sister on the left spoke now. Your two friends, the sons, are twins. Twins done in by twins. Same wounds to the throat, same pose on the floor. Seemed appropriate.
Appropriate?
Jean felt new anger building like pressure at the back of his skull. He ground his teeth together.
Mark my words, bitch. I've been wondering how I'd feel when this moment finally came, and I have to say I think I'm going to feel pretty fucking good.
The Barangius sisters shrugged off their cloaks with nearly identical motions. As the oilcloth fluttered to the floor, they threw down their light globes and drew out their other blades. Two sisters, four knives. They stared intently at Jean in the mingled red and white light and crouched, as they had 100 times before crowds of screaming thousands at the shifting revel. As they had 100 times before pleading victims in Kappa Barsavi's court.
"Wicked sisters," said Jean, as he let the hatchets fall out of his right robe sleeve and into his hand. "I'd like you to meet the wicked sisters."
3.
"But don't take it to amiss, Lucas," said Doña Sofia, as she set her hollowed-out orange back down on her shelf. "We have a few possible remedies."
"We might only be out of the necessary funds for a few days," said Don Lorenzo. "I have other sources I can tap. I do have peers who would be good for the loan of a few thousand. I even have some old favors I can call in."
That is a relief, my lord and lady, quite a relief. I am pleased to hear that your situation need not ruin our plan, and I wouldn't call it embarrassing, not at all. If anyone knows about financial hardship, why, it would be the House of Bel-Oster.
I shall speak to several of my likely sources of a loan next Idler's Day, which is, of course, the Day of Changes. Have you ever been to any formal celebration of the festival, Lucas?
I'm afraid not, Don Lorenzo. I have previously never been in Camor at the Midsummer Mark.
Really?
Doña Sofia raised her eyebrows at her husband.
"Why don't we bring Lucas with us to the Duke's feast?"
"An excellent idea,"
Don Lorenzo beamed at Locke.
"Lucas, since we can't leave until I've secured a few thousand more crowns anyway, why not be our guest? Every peer and Camor will be there, every man and woman of importance from the lower city."
"At least," said Doña Sofia, "the ones that currently have the Duke's favor."
"Of course," said Lorenzo. "Do come with us. The feast will be held in Raven's Reach. The Duke opens his tower only on this one occasion every year."
"My lord and Lady Salvara, this is quite an unexpected honor, but though I fear very much to refuse your hospitality, I also fear that it might possibly interfere with my ongoing work on our behalf."
"Oh, come, Lucas," said Lorenzo. "It's 4 days hence. You said you'd be supervising loading the first galleon for the next few days. Take a rest from your labors and come enjoy a very singular opportunity. Sophia can show you around while I press some of my peers for the loans I need. With that money in hand, we should be able to set out just a few days after that, correct? Assuming you've told us of every possible complication?"
"Yes, my lord Salvara, the matter of the second galleon is the only complication we face other than your, loss of fluidity. And at any rate, even its cargo for Balinel will not be in the city until next week. Fortune and the Marrows may be favoring us once again."
"It's settled, then?"
Doña Sofia linked hands with her husband and smiled.
"You'll be our guest at Raven's Reach?"
"It's accounted something of an honor," confided the Don,
to bring an unusual and interesting guest to the Duke's celebration, so we are eager to have you with us for several reasons.
If it would give you pleasure, said Locke, I fear that I am not much for celebrations, but I can set aside my work for a night to attend.
You won't be sorry, Lucas, said Doña Sofia. I'm sure we'll all think back very fondly on the feast when we begin our voyage.
4. In many ways, 2 was the worst possible number of multiple opponents in a close-quarters fight. It was nearly impossible to lead them into crowding and interfering with one another, especially if they were experienced at working together. And if anyone in Camor was any good at fighting in tandem, it was the Barangius sisters. Jean accounted his scant advantages as he twirled his hatchets and waited for one of the sisters to make the first move. He'd seen them in action at least a dozen times, at the shifting revel and in the floating grave. It might not do him much good, since he didn't happen to be a shark, but it was something.
"We've heard that you're supposed to be good," said the sister on his left, and just as she spoke, the one on the right exploded forward, one knife out in a guard position and the other held low to stab.
Jean sidestepped her lunge, blocked the thrusting knife with his left hatchet, and whipped the other one toward her eyes. Her second blade was already there. The hatchet rebounded off the studded handguard. She was as impossibly fast as he'd feared. So be it. He kicked out at her left knee, an easy trick he'd used to break a dozen kneecaps over the years. Somehow, she sensed the blow coming and bent her leg to deflect it. It struck her calf, pushing her off balance but accomplishing little else. Jean disengaged his hatchets to swing at where she should be falling, but she turned her sideways fall into a whirlwind kick. She swiveled on her left hip faster than his eyes could follow, and her right leg whipped around in a blurred arc. That foot cracked against his forehead, right above his eyes, and the whole world shuddered. Chasson, of course, he could really learn to hate the art. He stumbled backward. Drilled instinct alone saved him from her follow-up, a straight thrust that should have punched through his solar plexus and buried her blade to the hilt. He swung his hatchets down and inward, a maneuver Don Maranzala had jokingly referred to as the crab's claws. He hooked her blade with his right-hand hatchet and yanked it sideways. That actually surprised her. Jean took advantage of her split-second hesitation to ram the tip of his other hatchet into the base of her neck. He didn't have time for an actual swing, but he could give a pretty forceful poke. She stumbled back, coughing, and he suddenly had a few feet of space once again. He stepped back another yard. The wall of the warehouse was looming behind him, but at a range of scant inches those knives were greatly superior to his own weapons. He needed reach to swing. The left-hand Barangius dashed forward as the one on the right faded back, and Jean swore under his breath. With his back to the wall, they couldn't try to take him from opposite sides, but he couldn't run, and they could trade off attacks, one falling back to recover while the other sister continued to wear him down. His temper rose again. Bellowing, he tossed both of his hatchets at his new opponent. That caught her by surprise. She sidestepped with speed that matched her sister, and the weapons whirled past on either side, one of them catching at her hair. But Jean hadn't been in earnest with his gentle throw. He charged at her, hands outstretched. Empty hands would do better against thieves' teeth when opponents were close enough to kiss. The sister before him spread her blades again, confident of a quick kill. Yet it was easy to underestimate Jean's own speed if one hadn't seen it up close before. His hands clamped down on her forearms. Putting his strength and mass to good use, he spread her arms forcefully. As expected, she raised one of her legs to give him a sharp kick. Digging his fingers into the hard muscle of her forearms, keeping her blades firmly to the outside, he yanked as hard as he could. She flew forward, and with a smack that echoed in the warehouse, her nose met Jean's forehead. Hot blood spattered. It was on his robes, but he hoped Azaguia might eventually forgive him that little indignity. Before his opponent could recover, Jean let her arms go, cupped her entire face in one of his hands, and pushed from the hip with all of his might, like a shot putter at the Therin throne games of old. She flew into her sister, who barely got her blades out of the way in time to avoid skewering her sibling, and the Barangius twins toppled against the tarp-covered pile of corpses. Jean ran to the center of the warehouse floor, where his hatchets lay on the dirt. He picked them up, twirled them once, and quickly worked at the little clasp that held his robe together beneath the collar. While the sisters recovered themselves, Jean shrugged out of his robe and let it fall to the ground. The Barangius twins advanced on him again, about 10 feet apart, and now they looked distinctly upset. Gods, Jean thought, most men would take a broken nose as a sign to run like hell, but the sisters continued to bear down on him, malice gleaming in their dark eyes. The eerie red and white light was at their back, and it seemed to outline them in eldritch fire as they spread their blades for another pass at him. At least he had room to maneuver now. Without a word between them, the Barangia sisters took to their heels and rushed at him, four knives gleaming. It was their own professionalism that saved Jean this time. He knew before it happened that one would faint and one would strike home. The sister on his left, the one with a broken nose, attacked a split second before the one on his right. With his left-hand hatchet raised as a guard, he stepped directly into the path of the one on his left. The other sister, eyes wide in surprise, lunged at the space he'd just slipped out of, and Jean swung his right-hand hatchet in a backhand arc, ball first, that caught her directly atop her skull. There was a wet crack, and she hit the floor hard, knives falling from her nerveless fingers. The remaining sister screamed, and Jean's own mistake caught up with him at that moment. A feint can become a killing strike once more with very little effort. Her blade slashed out just as he was raising his right-hand hatchet once again. He caught and deflected one with his raised hatchet, but the other slid agonizingly across his ribs just beneath his right breast, laying open skin and fat and muscle. He gasped, and she kicked him in the stomach, staggering him. He toppled onto his back. She was right on top of him, blood streaming down her face and neck, eyes full of white-hot hate. As she lunged down, he kicked out with both of his legs. The air exploded out of her lungs, and she flew back, but there was a sharp pain in his right biceps, and a line of fire seemed to erupt on his left thigh. Damn, she'd had her blades in him when he pushed her back. She'd slashed open a ragged line along the top of his thigh with his help. He groaned. This had to end quickly, or blood loss would do for him as surely as the blades of the surviving sister. She was back on her feet already. Gods, she was fast. Jean heaved himself up to his knees, feeling a tearing pain across his right ribs. He could feel warm wetness cascading down his stomach and his legs. That wetness was time running out. She was charging at him again. Red light gleamed on steel, and Jean made his last move. His right arm didn't feel strong enough for a proper throw, so he tossed his right-hand hatchet at her, underhand, directly into her face. It didn't have the speed to injure, let alone kill, but she flinched for a second, and that was long enough. Jean whipped his left-hand hatchet sideways and into her right knee. It broke with the most satisfying noise Jean could recall hearing in his life. She staggered. A rapid yank and a backhand whirl, and his blades bit deep into the front of her other knee. Her blades came down at him then, and he threw himself sideways. Steel whistled just past his ears as its wielder toppled forward, unable to bear weight on her legs any longer. She screamed once again. Jean rolled several times to his right, a wise decision. When he stumbled up to his feet, clutching at his right side, he saw the surviving sister dragging herself toward him, one blade still held tightly in her right hand.
"You're bleeding hard, Tannen. You won't live out the night, you fucking bastard!"
"That's gentleman, bastard," he said. "And there's a chance I won't. But you know what? Carlo and Galdo Sanza are laughing at you, bitch."
He wound up with his left arm and let his remaining hatchet fly, a true throw this time, with all the strength and hatred he could put behind it. The blade struck home right between the Barangia sister's eyes. With the most incredible expression of surprise on her face, she fell forward and sprawled like a rag doll. Jean wasted no time in reflection. He gathered his hatchets and threw on one of the sisters' oilcloaks, putting up the hood. His head was swimming. He recognized all the signs of blood loss, which he'd had the misfortune to experience before. Leaving the bodies of the Barangius sisters in the light of the fallen glow globes, he stumbled back out into the night. He would avoid the cauldron, where some sort of trouble was sure to lurk, and make a straight run across the north of the wooden waste. If he could just make it to the Ashfall hovel, Ibelius would be there, and Ibelius would have some trick up his sleeves. If the dog-leech attempted to use a poultice on him, however, Jean was likely to break his fingers. 5. In her solarium atop Amberglass Tower, Doña Vorcenza spent the midnight hour in her favorite chair, peering at the evening's notes. There were reports of the ongoing strife from the Grey King's ascension to Barsavi's seat. More thieves found lying in abandoned buildings with their throats slashed. Vorcenza shook her head. This mess was really the last thing she needed with the affair of the Thorn finally coming to a head. Raza had identified and exiled half a dozen of her spies among the gangs. That in itself was deeply troubling. None of them had been aware of one another as agents. So either all of her agents were clumsier than she'd suspected, or Raza was fantastically observant. Or there was a breach in her trust at some level above the spies on the street. Damnation. And why had the man exiled them, rather than slaying them outright? Was he trying to avoid antagonizing her? He'd certainly not succeeded. It was time to send him a very clear message of her own, to summon this Kappa Raza to a meeting with Stephen, with 40 or 50 black jackets to emphasize her points. The elaborate locks to her solarium door clicked, and the door slid open. She hadn't been expecting Stephen to return this evening. What a fortunate coincidence. She could give him her thoughts on the Raza situation. The man that entered her solarium wasn't Stephen Reynard. He was a rugged man, lean-cheeked and dark-eyed. His black hair was slashed with grey at his temples, and he strolled into her most private chamber as though he belonged there. He wore a grey coat, grey breeches, grey hose, and grey shoes. His gloves and vest were grey, and only the silk neckcloths tied casually above his chest had colour. They were blood red. Doña Vorcenza's heart hammered. She put a hand to her chest and stared in disbelief. Not only had the intruder managed to open the door, and done so without taking a crossbow bolt in the back, but there was another man behind him. A younger man, bright-eyed and balding, dressed in a similar grey fashion, with only the bright scarlet cuffs of his coat to set him apart.
"Who the hell are you?"
she bellowed, and for a moment that age-weakened voice rose to something like its old power. She rose from her seat, fists clenched.
"How did you get up here?"
"We are your servants, my Lady Vorcenza. Your servants come to pay you our proper respects at last. You must forgive us our previous discourtesy. Things have been so busy of late in my little kingdom."
"You speak as though I should know you, sir. I ask your name."
"I have several," said the older man, "but now I am called Kappa Raza. This is my associate, who styles himself the Falconer, and as for now, we came to your truly lovely solarium."
He gestured to the Falconer, who held up his left hand, palm spread toward Doña Vorcenza. The coat sleeve fell away, revealing 3 thick black lines tattooed at his wrist.
"Gods," Vorcenza whispered, "a bondsmage."
"Indeed," said Kappa Raza, "for which, forgive me, but his art seemed the only way to ensure that your servants would haul us up here, and the only way to ensure that we could enter your sanctum without disturbing you beforehand."
"I am disturbed now," she spat. "What is your meaning here?"
"It is past time," said Raza, "for my associate and I to have a conversation with the Duke's spider."
"What are you speaking of? This is my tower. Other than my servants, there is no one else here.
True, said Caparaza. So there is no need to maintain your little fiction before us, my lady.
You, said Doña Vorcenza coldly and levelly, are greatly mistaken.
Those files behind you, what are they? Recipes? Those notes beside your chair. Does Stephen Reynard give you regular reports on the cuts and colors of this year's new dresses, fresh off the docks? Come, my lady. I have very unusual means of gathering information, and I am no dullard. I would construe any further dissembling on your part as a deliberate insult.
I regard your uninvited presence here, said Doña Vorcenza after a moment of consideration, as nothing less.
I have displeased you, said Raza, and for that I apologize. But have you any means to back that displeasure with force? Your servants sleep peacefully. Your Reynard and all of your midnighters are elsewhere, prying into my affairs. You are alone with us, Doña Vorcenza, so why not speak civilly? I have come to be civil and to speak in earnest.
She stared coldly at him for several moments, and then waved a hand at one of the solarium's armchairs.
Have a seat, Master Revenge. I fear there's no comfortable chair for your associate.
It will be well, said the falconer. I'm very fond of writing desks.
He settled himself behind the little desk near the door, while Raza crossed the room and sat down opposite Doña Vorcenza.
Revenge indeed. And have you had it?
I have, said Caparaza cheerfully. I find it's everything it's been made out to be.
You bore Capa Barsavi some grudge?
Ha! Some grudge, yes. It could be said that's why I had his sons murdered while he watched, and then fed him to the sharks he so loved.
Old business between the two of you?
I have dreamed of Vencarlo Barsavi's ruin for 20 years. Said Raza, and now I've brought it about, and I've replaced him. I'm sorry if this affair has been an inconvenience for you, but that is all that I am sorry for.
Barsavi was not a kind man, said Vorcenza. He was a ruthless criminal, but he was perceptive. He understood many things the lesser coppers did not. The arrangement I made with him bore fruit on both sides.
And it would be a shame to lose it, said Raza. I admire the secret peace very much, Doña Vorcenza. My admiration for it is quite distinct from my loathing for Barsavi. I should like to see the arrangement continued in full. I gave orders to that effect on the very night I took Barsavi's place.
So my agents tell me, said Doña Vorcenza. But I must confess I had hoped to hear it in your own words before now.
My delay was unavoidable, said Raza. But there we are. I have terrible manners, to which I readily admit. Allow me to make it up to you.
How so?
I should greatly enjoy a chance to attend the Duke's Day of Changes feast. I am capable of dressing and acting rather well. I could be introduced as a gentleman of independent means. I assure you, no one in Raven's Reach would recognize me. I gazed up at these towers as a boy in Camor. I should like to pay my proper respects to the peers of Camor just once. I would not come without gifts. I have something rather lavish in mind.
That, said Doña Vorcenza slowly, may be too much to ask. Our worlds, Caparaza, are not meant to meet. I do not come to your thieves' revels.
Yet your agents do, he said cheerfully.
No longer. Tell me, why did you order them exiled?
The penalty for turncoating among your people is death, so why didn't they merit a knife across the throat?
Would you really prefer them dead, Doña Vorcenza?
Hardly, but I am curious about your motives.
I, for my part, thought they were transparent. I need to have a measure of security. I simply cannot leave your agents lying about underfoot as Barsavi did. Of course, I didn't want to antagonize you more than necessary, so I presumed letting them live would be a friendly gesture. Doña Vorcenza, said Raza, I have every confidence that you will begin the work of inserting new agents into the ranks of my people almost immediately. I welcome it. May the most subtle planner win. But we have set aside the main point of this conversation.
Caparaza, said the Doña, you do not seem to be a man who needs sentiments wrapped in delicacy to salve his feelings. So let me be plain. It is one thing entirely for the two of us to have a working relationship, to preserve the secret peace for the good of all Camor. I am even content to meet with you here, if I must, assuming you are properly invited and escorted, but I simply cannot bring a man of your station into the Duke's presence.
That is disappointing, said Caparaza. Yet he can have Giancana Maraggio as a guest, can he not? A man who utilized my predecessor's services on many occasions, and many other captains of shipping and finance who profited from arrangements with Barsavi's gangs. The secret peace enriches every peer of Camor. I am, in effect, their servant. My forbearance keeps money in their pockets. Am I truly so base a creature that I cannot stand by the refreshment tables a while and merely enjoy the sights of the affair? Wander the sky garden and satisfy my curiosity?
Caparaza, said Doña Vorcenza, you are plucking at strings of conscience that will yield no sound. I am not the Duke's spider because I have a soft heart. I mean you no insult, truly, but let me frame it in these terms. You have been Capa now for barely 1 week. I have only begun to form my opinion of you. You remain a stranger, sir. If you rule a year from now, and you maintain stability among the right people, and preserve the secret peace, well then, perhaps some consideration could be given to what you propose.
And that is how it must be?
That is how it must be, for now.
Alas, said Caparaza, this refusal pains me more than you could know. I have gifts that I simply cannot wait until next year to reveal to all the peers of this fair city. I must, with all apologies, refuse your refusal.
What on earth do you mean?
Falconer.
The bondsmage stood up at Doña Vorcenza's writing desk. He'd taken a quill in his hands and set one of her sheets of parchment out before him.
Doña Vorcenza, he said as he wrote in a bold, looping script. Angiovesta Vorcenza, is it not? What a lovely name. What a very lovely, very true name.
In his left hand the silver thread wove back and forth. His fingers flew, and on the page a strange silver-blue glow began to arise. Angiovesta Vorcenza was outlined in that fire, and across the room the Doña moaned and clutched her head.
I am sorry to press my case by less than amiable means, Doña Vorcenza, said Caparaza, but can you not see that it would be to the Duke's very great advantage to have me as his guest? Surely you would not want to deny him those gifts which I would place at his feet with all due respect.
I cannot say. Yes, said the falconer. Oh, yes, you would be very pleased to accept this idea, to ensure that Caparaza was invited.